Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. Today, a fascinating look at the history of America's war on some drugs. Professor Alexandra Chasen will join me in a moment. Her book profiles the guy who really launched the war on drugs back in the 1930s. You've never heard of him before. His name is Harry Anslinger. And the professor comments on some of the current issues about opioids and marijuana regulation in our conversation as well. Our opening music right now is from a group that I enjoy called The War on Drugs. Check them out. And before we get started, I want to thank the people who subscribe to this podcast and support my work. People like Aiden McAleer, Andy Krieger, Jason Spitzer, and Joe Carson. Thank you one and all. And if you're not a subscriber, fix that, will you? Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Click on the menu button. Pull it down. It takes you over to become a subscriber, the sign-up page. And in minutes, you can be all set up and good to go. Today on the Peter B. Collins podcast, a look at the war on some drugs.
Picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies. Somebody calls you, you answer quite slowly. A girl with kaleidoscope eyes.
Remember the part about the kaleidoscope eyes. The Beatles, and that's Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. At the time it was released, a lot of people thought it was about drugs. I've never known for sure. Joining me today is the author of a fascinating new book about the origins of America's war on drugs. Alexandra Chasen has just published Assassin of Youth, A Kaleidoscopic History of Harry J. Anslinger's War on Drugs. Professor, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, Peter. It's wonderful to have the opportunity to talk with you.
And your book is really a very inventive approach to the subject. Explain to our listeners why you decided to take a kaleidoscopic approach.
There are a few reasons that I wanted to take that kind of approach. One is that I wanted to be able to include a lot of primary historical documents. And so the book is structured as a series of 48 short chapters, each of which is a kind of meditation on a different historical document. And I wanted to show the range of historical documents that are relevant to the war on drugs, because I wanted to show the broad range of cultural inputs, of disciplines that have treated the matter, of kinds of thought on drugs and how they should be handled legally. And so to have a huge variety of primary historical documents is fun visually, but it also gives a sense of some of that range. And the other main reason that I wanted to take an unconventional approach to writing about the war on drugs is that this book focuses very heavily on Harry J. Anslinger, who was the first commissioner of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, or the first drug czar. Mm-hmm. He was in that role from 1930 to 1962. So he was really very, very influential, and is largely responsible for the kind of drug law and policy that we still have now.
He was the J. Edgar Hoover of drugs.
He was the J. Edgar Hoover of drugs, although he didn't quite have the personality that Hoover had. He did have some of the politics, and he did have a little bit of the same kind of power. The thing about Anslinger is, of course, as drugs are, he was a disciplinarian. He was a law and order guy. He was into harsh penalties, and especially harsh penalties for repeat offenders and for, and again, we have this still with us today, mandatory minimum sentencing.
Yeah.
Because of those features of the way he thought and the kind of political action he endorsed, I wanted to write the opposite way. I wanted to write sentences that were maximal, that were not mandatory and minimum. I wanted to write sentences that in their very nature rejected or resisted the kind of thinking that made Anslinger the kind of drug czar that he was.
Now, I've got to say, you're a hell of a writer, Alexandra Chasen, and you really show your skills in this book, and you take us on, it's not quite a romp, but it's a bit of a wild ride through the history, driven by these documents, with a very personal approach to your main subject, who you refer to repeatedly by his first name. And I'm tempted to ask, you know, how did you meet him, and how much time did he spend telling you about all the things that he did?
Well, yes, the book takes a number of poetic licenses. And among them, I guess, is a kind of presumed familiarity with Harry Anslinger. And so I do call him Harry. And that's another reason that I wanted to think of this more as a history than a biography. I didn't actually want to be beholden to the conventions of biography, according to which you honor your subject. And this is a person whose politics I very much dislike. And I think that his policies have had enormously destructive social effect and for a very long time. And so I lack the basic attitude a biographer arguably should have toward her subject. I don't really honor him or his work. So that's also partly what accounts for the crazy kind of style, was I wanted to distinguish this book from a biography, even though it is very heavily focused on Anslinger. It's focused on him so heavily because he was so heavily involved in the establishment of prohibitionist drug law and policy. But he's not the only factor there, far from it. And so I wanted, again, to be able to range around and look at part of what made him who he was and what things were swirling around him culturally that went into the development of the law and policy that we have, besides just his biographical account.
Let's talk a little bit about you. You studied at Brandeis. You got your PhD at Stanford. You taught at Boston College and lectured at Columbia. You're now at the Lang College. That's at the New School, right?
Correct.
And what drove your interest in Harry Anslinger and the war on drugs?
About 20 years ago, maybe a little bit less, I was teaching a course about the prison industrial complex in the United States. And to me, the salient feature of prisons at that time, and it is still true, is that the prison population is very disproportionately composed of young Latino and African-American men who are doing time for minor nonviolent drug offenses. It was salient to me because of the racial skew in the prison population, and also because this strikes me, frankly, as a bad reason to put people in prison. And so I began to wonder, how did we get there? How did we get to not only a mass incarceration system, which we currently have, but one that in particular very effectively targets and ultimately disenfranchises so many Latino and African-American men?
Let me ask, I looked in my garage for an actual kaleidoscope, but we cleared it out a while back, and I couldn't find one to bring in. But let me shake the kaleidoscope here to the present, and then we'll go back for a deeper dive into your book. Just in the last couple of days, the new administration has finally found a job for Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey. he's going to head up a task force to take a look at addiction, particularly to opioids. And at the same time, Claire McCaskill, senator from Missouri, was grilling executives of the Purdue Pharmaceutical Company and others about the proliferation of OxyContin and its companion drugs, and the way it has been marketed so recklessly that millions of people in this country are now addicted. And when they get cut off the prescription drugs, many of them move to heroin, and we're seeing a huge wave of heroin overdoses, a 33% increase in the last 5 years alone. This is a very critical issue, and it is driven by a for-profit licensed drug cartel. Would you agree?
I do agree, and I think it's a tragic situation. One of the strange facts about the war on drugs, and this has been true going back a really long time, is that there are both legal and illegal sources of drugs. It seems almost too plain to say, but it's an important point. You have a legal market and you have a black market, and they operate differently, but the medical supply is kind of the pivot point and doctors kind of the gateway where good drugs can go bad. And there's examples of this all throughout the history, but what we have right now is a really crushing irony. That is the legal market that is actually supplying a lot of the drugs that are addicting people to opioids and doing so much damage along health lines and social lines.
And I know people with serious and chronic pain, and I do not want to deny them access to relief. At the same time, the overprescribing of these opioid drugs is very clear now, and I don't see anyone who's been held accountable. I think Purdue is still paying executive bonuses.
Well, I mean, that's the trouble with a legal market.
Mm-hmm.
Or rather, that's the trouble with a legal market under a kind of free-range capitalism. That is, I think that the profit effects are primary. And especially with our current administration, it's hard to imagine what kind of regulation it would take to bring this under control, but clearly some oversight is called for.
Now, at the same time, on a brighter note, Senator Ron Wyden and his congressional colleague Earl Blumenauer from Oregon have finally introduced a comprehensive set of bills to address essentially normalizing federal law against the states who have legalized marijuana either for medical or for adult use. And they're addressing the tax issues, the banking issues, descheduling marijuana from the Drug Enforcement Act's schedule where it's up there with LSD and heroin, also trying to fix the inconsistency between federal and state laws, and also to provide some expungement of criminal convictions based on nonviolent marijuana crimes. Have you had a chance to look at this, and what's your comment?
Well, of course, I'm in favor of all of those approaches and more. It won't surprise you to know that I'm in favor of full legalization. Of course, that is something that we've seen moves toward in other countries, and most of the most feared specters do not come to pass. It looks like crime rates do not go up. It looks like addiction rates do not go up, maybe a tiny bit, super incrementally, negligible. And so I'm all for that because I believe that a criminal justice approach impedes public health frameworks, and that public health frameworks seem to me like the way to treat addiction if that is what the government and the society are really truly concerned with. Marijuana looks like a special case, right? Because it looks like it's kind of peeling off from the other Schedule I drugs. Speculation is, of course, foolhardy, but it didn't stop me from speculating before the November election that if California voted for marijuana, which it did, that was tantamount to a kind of federal move because California is just so big and the crop's so big, the economy's mm-hmm. so big. It's a little bit confusing right now because obviously we have in the person of Jeff Sessions an attorney general who is not willing to say that the feds will leave this matter to the states. And it's ironic because in so many ways they are pro-states' rights.
Oh, yeah, right.
Here.
Except on abortion and drugs.
Exactly. One thing when it's women's bodies and another thing when it's narcotics. And so I think it's a little bit hard to guess right now, harder than I thought it was when I was already wrong last fall. But I do think we're going to look at a struggle to keep marijuana moving as a separate issue to reschedule it. What marijuana's trajectory is one thing, but in any case, even if marijuana continues essentially a path toward full legalization, it won't do anything to change the prohibitionist law and policy that are the bulwark of our approach to the other narcotics that are going to remain scheduled as they currently are.
Professor, in your view, does prohibition of drugs in any event work?
It works for some things, but it doesn't accomplish its own stated purpose. To me, one of the most kind of mysterious elements of the war on drugs is why we have a set of law and policy that, even though it fails to meet its own stated goals, year in, year out, going on 70 plus years, why is this program so durable and so popular? It must be doing something. What it is not doing is eliminating or even significantly reducing drug traffic or drug use. That's what I mean by failing at its own stated goals.
Well, but it's providing, you know, huge windfalls for law enforcement agencies that grab drug money and cars and all that stuff and divert it into their internal systems. It's working for the prison industry complex that has full houses these days. We're still trying to comply with a federal court order to reduce the prison population here in California. And so it is really driven by the beneficial impacts to the people who run the war.
Well, I agree with that. And I also think it's not an overstatement, in my opinion, to say it is also succeeding at a kind of racist and classist administration or social control that must be perceived by enough people or people in positions of power as socially beneficial. So it has all the benefits you named, and it really devastates communities whose devastation is, again, I think this is not too cynical in interpretation, advantageous to upper class and governing structures.
Professor, I was sharply critical of President Obama and Attorney General Holder on many issues related to domestic terrorism investigations, the domestic surveillance system, and the rogue agency that we call the FBI. But both of them had the right intentions and made moves in the right directions to the massive number of commutations and pardons that Obama wrote to clear some of the federal prisons of people who were caught up in minimum mandatory sentences and other excessive penalties. But he declined to reschedule marijuana on the Drug Enforcement Act's chart. And that was something that could have been done with a stroke of a pen. And for whatever reason, Obama came up short. Do you share my criticism there?
I absolutely do. I wish that he had done that. I watched those commutations also with some amount of gratification, but there are a lot of stones left unturned. We haven't untied the hands of judges. I feel that Obama probably could have done more. And I think, I don't know if it was just he perceived that as being too unpopular or what inhibited him there. But yeah, the fight's still on.
Alexandra Chasen is my guest. Her new book is called Assassin of Youth, and it is, as we've referenced, a kaleidoscopic history of Harry J. Anslinger. And I was fascinated by the early chapters of the book, Professor, because my dad and my grandfather were both railroad men. And Harry Anslinger grew up in Altoona, Pennsylvania, the headquarters of the Pennsylvania Railroad Company, and it was almost a paramilitary organization. He got involved in railroad security, and that led to his career as as an enforcer. Talk a little bit about his origins and how the rules of the railroad were, imbued on Harry Anslinger.
So Anslinger was born in 1892. And Altoona, as you said, was the headquarters of the machine shops of the Pennsylvania Railroad Company. Already by 1880, I think that the Pennsylvania Railroad Company was considered to be one of the, if not the largest corporation in the country, possibly in the world, tens of thousands of employees, and a very elaborate kind of organization, divisions and subdivisions and departments and sub-departments, and as you referenced, lots and lots of rules and regulations. One of my theories about Harry is that he grew up learning the culture and ways of the ascendant large corporation, and that when he went into government service, he transferred some of what he had learned in the corporate landscape to the elaboration of government bureaucracy. But when he was a child, he was living in Altoona, totally a company town. I would guess that the vast majority of boys and men who lived in Altoona worked at the railroad company. And Harry, like them, starting sometime in early in high school, probably cut back his school hours and stepped up his hours working. And he worked his way up through the company, had a number of different jobs. But his last one, as you said, was in the security department, where he did a piece of detective work that may have saved the company something like $50,000, a tremendous amount of money in those days. So with his flair for detection, he turned to government bureaucracy, again, not just with some of the ways and means of the corporation, but with a particular personal investment in a persona as an enforcer.
So he went to work at the state government in Harrisburg. Then he moved up to the feds. He served in Germany for a while, and then they sent him to an outpost in Venezuela, where he might have thought that he had been forsaken. But then he managed to arrive back in Washington at the time that President Hoover created the new Bureau of Narcotics. Explain a little bit about how he was in the right place at the right time.
So what Anslinger was doing in Venezuela, and then he did another stint in the Bahamas, and yes, he felt he had been forsaken. Letters and memoranda from him seemed to indicate that he was begging for reassignment. But what he was doing while he was there was prohibition work. He was tracking boats coming in and boats coming out. And in Nassau, he seems to have distinguished himself by getting England and France to agree to have boats sign forms that would indicate something about their origin and their destination. So it was actually a bureaucratic coup, a very small one. He got some countries to use some forms. This brought him to the attention of Washington. And because of this success in the prohibition context, he was installed first just on an interim basis, but then he became the permanent commissioner of the brand new Federal Bureau of Narcotics. This is in 1930, just as alcohol prohibition is on its way out the door. So there's also a very close relationship between alcohol and drug prohibition.
And this it fascinates me because, of course, I certainly wasn't there for those debates. But it's hard to understand how the nation could accept its big error on alcohol prohibition and the repeal of the Volstead Act, and really in the same window of time, be cracking down on drugs about which they had very little scientific knowledge. And, you know, the way that opium was treated almost as the same as, say, cocaine or marijuana, there was just a lot of ignorance that drove many of these kind of emotional decisions. But it's hard to understand how sane people traded one failed scheme of prohibition for a new one.
Well, yes, that's that is mysterious. There were things that were not known at the time, and there's things that were known. Of course, what was known was a tremendous amount about the particular disaster that was alcohol prohibition, beginning with the forfeiture of a tremendous amount of revenue, including the heightened inducement to corruption on the part of enforcement officers, because you make a lot more money selling bootleg liquor or illegal narcotics than you do as a law enforcement agent, including lack of regulation of product. That is to say that if nobody's controlling alcohol production in some central or standardized way, there's bad booze that's more dangerous that goes to people. That's obviously still true today with drugs that are whose production is unregulated, and we have all kinds of dangerous substances cut into narcotics that make taking them much more dangerous and in lots of cases lethal. And wherever you have, again, a black market, you have a certain stigma. You have a lack of oversight to any transaction within that market. All the parties to it are breaking the law. And so you don't have journalistic oversight. You don't have government oversight. That's true now. So all of that was known about prohibition, the very definition and nature of prohibition during the experiment with alcohol. And it was pretty widely agreed, although Anslinger was apparently one of the very last to agree. He seemed to think that if enforcement was beefed up, prohibition could work. He was, of course, outvoted, and alcohol prohibition went down. But I sometimes think that drugs stepped in to take up the social burden that alcohol had been carrying. So when alcohol went good, drugs went bad.
Is there also a racial component here? Because, you know, during this period of time, there was grave concern about intermingling of the races and the notion that many urban blacks who had come to work in the factories, I'm thinking specifically of Chicago now, were, you know, of a lower moral order, and that they dabbled in weed and to some extent in cocaine. And you know, this seemed to be part of a piece with segregation.
I mean, definitely these things are absolutely linked. And one of the reasons that I wanted to go back before Harry got in office and even before he was born to understand the origins of the war on drugs is that there was already a link forged between Chinese immigrants and opium, which kind of set the stage. Harry was able to borrow that same logic and establish further links between particular drugs and particular social and immigrant groups. So you're absolutely right that racial issues absolutely pervade the whole question of drugs and how we were going to handle them socially and legally. Chicago, of course, comes in for a special role, almost as it seems to do again today. Harry Anslinger wrote, and this is the origin of my book's title, Assassin of Youth, that comes from the name of an article that Anslinger published in a nationally circulating magazine in 1937. By Assassin of Youth, he meant marijuana. Mm-hmm. And he opens the article with a paragraph about a white woman sprawled on the sidewalk outside an apartment building in Chicago. She's gone out the window of a marijuana party somewhere upstairs. I think this is apocryphal. I tried extremely hard to find this woman, I can't prove that she didn't exist, but I see no evidence that she did exist. Mm-hmm. And I think, therefore, it's really interesting that this is an image of concern to Anslinger. It's a very old image in terms of threat to white women in this country, which is a specter that goes back to antebellum days, mm-hmm. imagining the threat to the purity and sanctity of white womanhood has been a kind of a racist trope for a very long time. And Anslinger runs with that in his story, Assassin of Youth. The inner city was not just a place where it was imagined that racial others were concentrated, but also where immigrant groups were concentrated, and in particular, multiple immigrant groups. It's actually the original multicultural zone. And Anslinger, along with a number of social scientists of the day, feared the inner city as a place where, because there was no monoculture, there was nothing unifying these immigrants, that was a place of a special moral degradation.
You cite a case where he was caught using the N-word in a memo. How racist was Harry?
I think he was pretty racist. He had certain employees use certain entrances. There's no question on a personal level that he was prejudiced. Mm-hmm. It's also true that that he was able to get law designed that would that would look like neutral mechanisms. And this is, again, what we have right now. The law at some level looks like a neutral mechanism, but actually is differently meaningful for people in different communities.
You're talking about the royal decrees about travel.
For example, yes. And so Anslinger kept a lot of files. He had one of the things he really liked to do was clip newspaper articles and keep little stories. He had a collection of clippings that he called the Gore Files, in which he collected examples of people who had been made criminally insane, who had by marijuana, who had smoked a joint and then done extremely violent things. And these Gore Files are completely populated by people of color. So he had an actual animus for sure. And it was personal for him, but he also was able to elevate it to a political level.
Now, you mentioned that he didn't quite have the power and influence of J. Edgar Hoover, but Hoover was very friendly with the press and got a lot of good press when he was busting the gangsters and then cracking down on commies. And Anslinger was no slouch. He appears, from the accounts in your book, to have enjoyed a very good relationship with the Hearst tabloid newspaper empire, and he could get these Gore File types of stories into the tabloid press, and it seems like he was pretty successful at that.
Well, Harry had a lot of bully pulpits, and certainly the Hearst papers allowed him to get his viewpoint around very widely. It was a network of papers for people who might not know. And so to get an op-ed, for example, in one newspaper, say in St. Louis, it would also appear in Oregon, in Maine, in numbers of papers. And so that was one way that he got his word out. He also spoke a lot publicly. He spoke for law enforcement agencies. He spoke to social clubs. He spoke to ladies' auxiliaries. He spoke to pharmacists' associations. So he spoke. He had a huge speaking circuit. He did a lot of that, and that was another way that he got around his word. He was considered an expert propagandist. And so that's another reason it's important to consider this article, Assassin of Youth, in which he's printing something that is apocryphal, which means not true, but absolutely serves a propagandistic purpose. It was published in 1937. It's the same year Reefer Madness comes out, which was also a powerful piece of propaganda, and is, not incidentally, the year that the Marijuana Tax Act is passed.
You introduced me to a movie star named Wallace Reed, and in the 1920s, he was seemed like he was making a movie every week. And he, in one of them, he did his own stunts and got injured, and that led to an addiction to morphine. And he, it appears, became kind of a poster child, one of these gore-file anecdotes. And as I read the account, it reminded me a little bit about the tabloid coverage of the overdose death more recently of Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yes, it's. I think that he kind of set a mold. Wallace Reed did. He was extremely popular, not just in the United States, also internationally, as a movie star in the first era of movie stars. So he was right in there with Douglas Fairbanks and Mary Pickford, who are preserved by history as the original movie stars. Wallace Reed was right in there with them until he got injured, as you say, and he started taking narcotics. He was injured in about 1919. By 1923, he was dead. And he had gone down in a very highly visible way because he himself was so highly visible as a movie star, but also because he partied sort of publicly. He ran a little bit of an open house, much to the chagrin of his wife, who was constantly trying to get him clean. And so there was a lot of buzz about his decline and fall. And so he was the first movie star gone bad. And I do think that he set the mold for some of the decadent Hollywood imagery and some of the particular vilifications or representations of troubled celebrities.
Later in your book, in a chapter called Spindoctrination, you talk about some of Harry Anslinger's public statements. And he was a real, proponent of punishment. 1945, Newsweek printed a quote, "To jail offenders and then throw away the key. Harry spoke in favor of capital punishment for people who sold drugs to children. If we have the death penalty for kidnappers who only steal children, why not the same punishment for dope peddlers who destroy them?" He came to reverse this position when he was convinced that such sentences would cause juries to acquit defendants out of fear of sending innocent people to the chair. Now, the modern extension of this, and carried to a lethal extent, is the new strongman leader of the Philippines, Eduardo Duterte, who has led a approval of vigilante justice. People are being executed, without any legal process, just suspected of being either drug users or sellers. And it seems like the current government in the Philippines represents the absolute extreme today in prohibition and extreme punishment.
Absolutely. The Philippines is a very scary case in point of the extension of the drug war to a real extreme. Of course, there's extrajudicial killings happening there. They're operating in a way that is illegal. I mean, the state is operating illegally by its own law. But in a sense, it is just the same logic exaggerated to a very extreme degree. And I believe that we heard President Trump praise President Duterte in terms of his handling of drugs. I don't believe that he meant to endorse extrajudicial killings, but I think we have a specter that we really need to keep an eye on there for sure.
Indeed. You spend part of that same chapter addressing the CIA and military in the United States' involvement with the development of weaponized drugs. And you talk about MK Ultra, Sidney Gottlieb. Was your work there informed by the incredible book by H.P. Alborelli called, now that I've mentioned it, I'm trying, I can't summon the title, but he wrote a book that was published about 7 or 8 years ago about the case that you describe here, where Frank Olson, who was officially declared a suicide, had been thrown out the 10th story window of a hotel in New York City. A Terrible Mistake, that's the name
of it. Terrible Mistake is the book, and I absolutely did rely upon it. And it is true The CIA was in the business. What happened was they were looking for a truth serum. This is the original impetus behind the organization, is that they wanted there to be a drug that compelled takers to tell the truth. They thought that they could get enemies to spill enemy secrets that way. No such substance has been found or invented, not then and not since. But there were lots of experiments along those lines. There were experiments in labs that were conducted by government-sponsored doctors. And there were also rogue agents who did some experimenting outside of the lines. So the role of special agents in the Federal Bureau of Narcotics is overlapping with the CIA agents because they actually, the FBI agents, I should say, because they actually traded, the agencies traded agents, they borrowed agents. And so some of the same exact guys worked cross-agency.
And let me quote a passage here from the book. You say, Harry Anslinger sat just outside the clique of elites who took experimental intelligence enterprises into their own hands. And Harry did not perform brain surgery on people who were alive and awake. He did not force feed anybody salt water or infect them with syphilis. But Harry kept the boat floating. If Gottlieb made the madness of Agent Orange, of Agent George White and Dr. Kligman possible, Harry in turn made Gottlieb possible every day of his working life, filing certain papers in certain compartments of the Bureau and sweeping others under the rug. Unspecial people like Harry hold down the world with order forms and budgets. People like him made people like Hoover possible. They balance the act of government bureaucracy while mad geniuses with expense accounts for multiple martinis per diem tear around, tipping international relations into the ocean of absurdity. With moral sleight of hand, Harry distracted the members of the social clubs, while very special operatives for the CIA and Federal Bureau of Narcotics did whatever the fuck they wanted or thought was a good idea. And what they wanted was large-scale violent overthrow of foreign governments. Now, this is a very powerful passage, and again, I compliment you for the writing. But you really nail it here, how functionaries enable the by keeping the machinery well-oiled and operating, they enable the excesses that do occur from time to time when people get too much power.
Right. So Hoover gets the spotlight. Hoover had the personality. Hoover was a household name. But I think that Harry and other people like Harry are super important, partly because they are out of the spotlight. Harry was known as a consummate bureaucrat. He was able to keep the trains running. And he was so good at his job, I believe, that he made it possible for some of the excesses that we've heard about to take place. So it's important because one of the theories of history is that history proceeds by the acts of great individuals, that individual geniuses do amazing things, and that's what makes history. But in fact, history proceeds along a lot of lines at the same time. Ordinary people make history every minute of their day, and people like Harry make history by growing bureaucracy, by working bureaucracy, and by establishing and maintaining channels through which some of those other excesses could take place.
Now, you wrap up your book pretty much at the time of the end of Harry's tenure in the war on drugs. But the Bureau of Narcotics was succeeded by the Drug Enforcement Agency. This was launched under President Nixon as he was trying to distract from his own criminal enterprises. And I'm curious if you have a comment on why the essential successors of Harry Anslinger really didn't have his tenure or his profile. I can't name a single head of the DEA since it was formed in the early 1970s.
Well, and most people would not have been able to name Anslinger for the duration of his career as well. So some of this is that we have the advantage of hindsight, and that's where we pick Anslinger out of the proverbial dustbin of history.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I think that, for one thing, Harry was in office for 32 years, so he was extremely stable. It's also important to note that as a commissioner, he was an appointee, and he was appointed by both Republican and Democratic presidents. He stayed in that job through five different administrations. In latter days, we tend not to have bipartisanly acceptable appointees. So that's another thing that has changed the political landscape, such that you could get a commissioner like that who is approved by Democrat and Republican and the next Democrat and the next Republican. I think that feeds into it as well. But the other thing about the war on drugs is that it's always complicated in terms of enforcement because it's a treasury. It basically belongs under Treasury because illegal drug trafficking is essentially an economic crime, but also enforcement is part of the gig. And so there's always tension between the different branches within which narcotics law and enforcement unfold and take place. And I think that that's part of what accounts for a little bit of instability in terms of the government of the drug war all the time, going back actually as far as Harry.
Professor, is there anything you'd like to add as we wrap up here?
No, it's been really great to talk to you. Lots of fun. And I would just make a plug for people's awareness of the damage that the war on drugs does. You referred to President Duterte of the Philippines, but I'd like to end by referring to President Santos of Colombia, who has gone on record saying that drug prohibition is worse, does more damage than the thing it is meant to address. That is the use of drugs. So the war on drugs does more damage than the drugs themselves. Keep an eye on it.
Alexandra Chasen. The book is Assassin of Youth, A Kaleidoscopic History of Harry J. Anslinger's War on Drugs. Thank you very much, Professor. Fascinating look at the origins of America's war on drugs. Send me your comments. Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to until we meet again, happy trails.